fool. People tried to warn me, but I wouldn't listen. The entire 6 months his divorce was in process, I nurtured and patted and petted and cooed. It worked, didn't it? Oh, I got what I wanted for all the good it did me. We were married the minute he was free, but his heart wasn't in it. He was hung up on her, which kept me hooked for a long time. I knew he didn't love me, so how could I resist the man? I had to fawn and grovel. I had to please him at any cost. Nothing worked, of course. I mean, basically, he prefers women as rejecting of him as he is of me. Isn't that pathetic? He'll probably fall head over heels in love with me the day I serve him with papers.
What changed your attitude? The cancer?
That was part of it. The lawsuit has had an effect on top of that. I realized at a certain point it was just his way of staying connected to Isabel. He can be embroiled. He can suffer on her behalf. If he can't have her, at least he can have the money. That's what matters now.
What about their daughter, Shelby? How does she fit into this?
She's a nice enough kid. He hardly sees her. She's hardly ever home. Once in a while, like every 2 or 3 months, he goes to visit at school and takes her out for the day. They go to dinner and a movie, and that's the extent of it.
I thought the legal wrangle was for her, to make sure she's provided for.
That's what he says, but it's ridiculous. He's heavily insured. If anything happened to him, Shelby'd get $1 million. How much more does she need? He refuses to let go. That's all the lawsuit's about. God, do I sound like a bitch?
Not at all. I appreciate your candor. Frankly, I didn't think you'd tell me much.
I'll tell you anything you want to know. I don't care about these people. I used to feel protective. There was a time I never would have said a word. I'd have felt guilty and disloyal. Now it doesn't seem to matter much. I've begun to see them with great clarity. It's like being nearsighted and suddenly getting prescription lenses. It's all so much clearer. It's astonishing.
Such as what?
Just what I've been talking about. Kenneth and his obsession. The hard part for him was once Isabel left him, he had to face the fact she was a flaming narcissist. With her dead, he can go back to believing she was perfect.
She and David met at work. Isn't that how it went? Peter Weidman's firm?
That's right. It was love at first sight, she said, making quote marks with her fingers.
You think he killed her?
David? I'm not sure how to answer that. During the trial, I sure thought so, but now it doesn't make much sense to me. I mean, look at the situation. Hasn't it ever struck you how feminine the murder was? It's always amazed me that no one's mentioned this before. I don't mean to sound sexist, but there's something almost sanitary about shooting through a peephole. Maybe it's my prejudice, but I tend to think when men kill, it's more forceful and direct. They strangle, or bludgeon, or stab. It's real straight-ahead stuff. Even when they shoot, there's nothing devious or sneaky. It's like, boom, they blow your head off. They don't tiptoe around.
In other words, men tend to kill face-to-face.
Exactly. Shooting through a peephole, you wouldn't have to take responsibility. You wouldn't even have to look at the blood, let alone risk getting spattered. David may have harassed her, but he was so visible about it. Right out there in front of God and everyone, restraining orders, cops, the two of them screaming at each other on the phone. If he really killed her, he must have known he'd be the first person they'd suspect. And that business about his jogging? What a stupid idea. Believe me, the man is smart. If he were guilty, then surely he could have come up with a better alibi than that.
But what are you suggesting? You must have some kind of theory or you wouldn't be saying this.
Simone's a possibility.
Isabel's twin sister?
Don't you know the story?
I guess not, I said, but I'm sure you'll fill me in. She laughed at my tone.
Well, look at the story. They never really got along. Isabel did as she pleased, and poor Simone was left holding the bag half the time. Isabel had everything, ostensibly at any rate. Looks, talent, a darling child. Ah, and that was the sticking point. Simone wanted to have a baby more than anything.
Her biological clock had jumped to daylight saving time. I take it you've met her?
I talked to her yesterday.
And you noticed the limp?
Sure, but she didn't mention it, and I didn't ask.
It was a terrible accident. Isabel's fault, I'm afraid. This was maybe 7 years ago, about a year before Iz died. Iz was drunk and brought the car home and left it in the driveway without pulling the emergency brake. The car started to roll down that horrendous hill, smashing through the underbrush, picking up momentum. Simone was at the mailbox, and it crashed right into her. Crushed her pelvis, crushed her femur. They said she'd never walk again, but she defied him on that. You probably saw for yourself. She's really doing very well.
But no kids.
That's right. And what made things worse, she was engaged at the time, and her fiancé broke it off. He wanted a family. End of story. For Simone, it really was the final straw. I watched her face, trying to compute the impact of the information.
It's worth some thought, I said.
Chapter 13. I stopped off at Rosie's on the way back to my place. I don't usually hang out in bars, but I was restless and I didn't feel like being alone just then. At Rosie's, I can sit in a back booth and ponder life circumstances without being stared at, picked up, hit on, or hassled. After the wine at Francesca's, I thought a cup of coffee might be in order. It wasn't really a question of sobering up. The wine at Francesca's was as delicate as violets. The white wine at Rosie's comes in big half-gallon screw-top jugs you can use later to store gasoline and other flammable liquids. Business was lively. A group of bowlers had come in, a noisy bunch of women who were celebrating their winning of some league tournament. They were parading around the room with a trophy the size of Winged Victory, all noise and whistles and cheers and stomping. Ordinarily, Rosie doesn't tolerate rowdies, but their spirits were contagious and she didn't object. I got myself a mug and filled it from the coffee pot Rosie keeps behind the bar. As I slid into my favorite booth, I spotted Henry coming in. I waved, and he took a detour and headed in my direction. One of the bowlers was feeding coins into the jukebox. Music began to thunder through the bar along with cigarette smoke, whoops, and raucous laughter. Henry slid in across from me and put his head down on his arm.
"This is great. Noise, whiskey, smoke, life. I'm so sick of being with that hypochondriac of a brother. He's driving me nuts. I swear to God, his health regimen occupied our entire day. Every hour on the hour he takes a pill or drinks a glass of water, flushing his system out. He does yoga to relax. He does calisthenics to wake up. He takes his blood pressure twice a day. He uses little strip tests to check his urine for glucose and protein. He keeps up a running account of all his body functions, every minor itch and pain. If his stomach gurgles, it's a symptom. If he breaks wind, he issues a bulletin. Like I didn't notice already. The man is the most self-obsessed, tedious, totally boring human being I've ever met, and he's only been here one day. I can't believe it. My own brother.
You want a drink?
I don't dare. I couldn't stop. They'd have to check me into detox.
Has he always been like that?
Henry nodded bleakly. I never really saw it till now. Or maybe in his dotage he's becoming decidedly worse. I remember as a kid he had all these accidents. He tumbled out of trees and fell off swings. He broke his arm once. He broke a wrist. He stuck a pencil in his eye and nearly blinded himself. And the cuts. Oh, my God, you couldn't let him near a knife. He had all kinds of allergies and weird things going wrong with him. He had a spastic salivary gland. He really did. Later he went through a 10-year period when he had all his internal organs taken out. Tonsils and adenoids, appendix, his gallbladder, one kidney, 2.5 feet from his upper intestine. The man even managed to rupture his spleen. Out it came. We could have constructed an entire human being out of the parts he gave up.
I glanced up to find Rosie standing at my shoulder, taking in Henry's outburst with a placid expression. "He's having a breakdown? His brother's visiting from Michigan. He don't like the guy. The man is driving him nuts. He's a hypochondriac." She turned to Henry with interest. "What's the matter with him? Is he sick?"
"No, he's not sick. He's neurotic as hell."
"Bring him in. I fix. Nothing to it."
"I don't think you quite understand the magnitude of the problem," I said.
"It's no problem. I can handle it. What's the fellow's name, this brother?"
"His name is William."
Rosie said, "William," as she wrote it in her little notebook. "It's done. I fix. Not to worry."
She moved away from the table, her moo-moo billowing out around her like a witch's cape.
"Is it my imagination, or has her English gotten worse lately?" I asked.
Henry looked up at me with a wan smile. I gave his hand a maternal pat.
"Cheer up. It's done. Not to worry. She'll fix."
I was home by 10 o'clock, but I didn't feel like continuing my cleaning campaign. I took my shoes off and used my dirty socks to do a half-hearted dusting of the spiral staircase as I went up to bed.
Works for me, I thought.
I was awakened in the wee hours with a telegram from my subconscious. "Pick up," the message read.
"Pick up what?"
My eyes came open, and I stared at the skylight above my bed. The loft was very dark. The stars were blocked out by clouds, but the glass dome seemed to glow with light pollution from town. The message had to be related to Tippy's presence at the intersection. I'd been brooding about the subject since David Barney first brought it up. If he was inventing, why attach her name to the story? She might have had a ready explanation for where she was that night. If he was lying about the incident, why take the chance? The repair crew had seen her, too. Well, not really her, but the pickup. Where else had I come across the mention of a pickup truck? I sat up in bed, pushed the covers back, and flipped on the light, wincing at the sudden glare. In lieu of a bathrobe, I pulled on my sweats. Barefoot, I padded down my spiral staircase, turned on the table lamp, and hunted up my briefcase, sorting through the stacks of folders I'd brought home from the office. I found the file I was looking for and carried it over to the sofa, where I sat, feet tucked up under me, leafing through old photocopies of the Santa Teresa Dispatch. For the third time in 2 months, I scanned column after column of smudgy print. Nothing for the 25th. Ah. On the front page of the local news for December 26th was the little article I'd seen about the hit-and-run fatality of an elderly man who'd wandered away from a convalescent hospital in the neighborhood. He'd been struck by a pickup truck on Upper State Street and had died at the scene. The name of the victim was being withheld, pending notification of his next of kin. Unfortunately, I hadn't made copies of the newspapers for the week after that, so I couldn't read the follow-up. I pulled out the telephone book and checked the yellow pages under convalescent homes and hospitals. The sublistings were homes, hospitals, nursing homes, rest homes, and sanitariums, most of which simply cross-referenced each other. Finally, under nursing homes, I found a comprehensive list. There was only one such facility in the vicinity of the accident. I made a note of the address and then turned the lights out and went back up to bed. If I could link that pickup to the one Tippy's father owned, it might go a long way toward explaining why she was reluctant to admit she was out. It would also verify every word David Barney'd said. In the morning, after my usual 3-mile run, a shower, breakfast, and a quick call to the office, I drove out to the South Rockingham neighborhood where the old man had been killed. At the turn of the century, South Rockingham was all ranchland. Flat fields planted to beans and walnuts, harvested by itinerant crews who traveled with steam engines, cookhouses, and bedroll wagons. An early photograph shows some 30 hands lined up in front of their cumbersome, clanking machinery. Most of the men were mustachioed and glum, wearing bandanas, long-sleeved shirts, overalls, and felt hats.
Staunchly they lean on their pitchforks while a dusty noon sun beats down. The land in such pictures always looks pitiless and flat. There are few trees, and the grass, if it grows at all, seems patchy and sparse. Later aerial photos show the streets radiating from a round hub of land, like the spokes of a wagon wheel. Beyond the outermost rim, the squares of young citrus groves are pieced together like a quilt. Now, South Rockingham is a middle-class neighborhood of modest custom-built homes, half of which went up before 1940. The balance were constructed during a mini-boom in the 10 years between 1955 and 1965. Every parcel is dense with vegetation, houses crowded onto every available lot. Still, the area is considered desirable because it's quiet, self-contained, attractive, and well-kept. I located the convalescent hospital, a one-story stucco structure flanked on three sides by parking lots. From the outside, the 50-bed facility looked plain and clean, probably expensive. I parked at the curb and climbed four concrete steps to the sloping front walk. The grass on either side was in its dormant stage, clipped short, a mottled yellow. An American flag hung limply from a pole near the entrance. I pushed through a wide door into a comfortably furnished reception area decorated in the style of one of the better motel chains. Christmas hadn't surfaced yet. The color scheme was pleasant, blues and greens in soothing, non-inflammatory shades. There was a couch covered in chintz and four matching upholstered chairs arranged so as to suggest intimate lobby chats. The magazines on the end table were neatly fanned out in an arc of overlapping titles, Modern Maturity being foremost. There were two ficus trees, which on closer inspection turned out to be artificial. Both might have used a dusting, but at least they weren't subject to whitefly and blight. At the desk, I asked to see the nursing home director and was directed to the office of a Mr. Hugo, halfway down the corridor to my left. This wing of the building was strictly administrative. There were no patients in evidence, no wheelchairs, gurneys, or medical paraphernalia. The very air was stripped of institutional odors. I explained my business briefly, and after a 5-minute wait, Mr. Hugo's personal secretary ushered me into his office. Nursing home directors must have a lot of holes to fill in their appointment books. Edward Hugo was a black man in his mid-60s with a curly mix of gray and white hair and a wide white mustache. His complexion was glossy brown, the color of caramel. The lines in his face suggested an origami paper folded once, then flattened out again. He was conventionally dressed, but something in his manner hinted at obligatory black tie appearance for local charity events. He shook my hand across his desk, and then took his seat again while I took mine. He folded his hands in front of him on the desk.
"What can I help you with?"
"I'm trying to learn the name of a former patient of yours, an old gentleman who was killed in a hit-and-run accident 6 years ago at Christmas." He nodded.
"I know the man you're referring to. Can you explain your interest?"
"I'm trying to verify an alibi in another criminal matter. It would help if I could find out if the driver was ever found."
"I don't believe so. Not to my knowledge, at any rate. To tell you the truth, it's always bothered me. The gentleman's name was Noah McKell. His son, Hartford, lives here in town. I can have Mrs. Rudolph look up his number if you'd like to speak to him."
He went on in this manner, direct, soft-spoken, and matter-of-fact, managing in our 10-minute conversation to give me all the information I needed in a carefully articulated format. According to Mr. Hugo's account of the night in question, Noah McKell had removed his IV, disconnected himself from a catheter, dressed himself in his street clothes, and left his private room by the window. I was surprised by that. "Aren't the windows kept locked?"
"This is a hospital, Miss Milhone, not a prison. Bars would constitute a danger if a fire ever broke out. Aside from that, we feel our patients benefit from the fresh air and a view of some greenery. He'd left the premises on two other occasions, which was a matter of great concern to us, given his condition. We considered the use of restraints for his protection, but we were reluctant to do so, and his son was adamant. We kept the bed rails up, and we had one of the aides look in on him every 30 minutes or so. The floor nurse went in at 1:15 and discovered the empty bed. Of course, we moved very quickly once we realized he was gone. The police were alerted, and the security people here began an immediate search. I received a call at home and came right over. I live up on Tecolote Road, so it didn't take me long. By the time I got here, we'd heard about the hit-and-run. We went to the scene and identified the body. Were there any witnesses? A desk clerk at the Gypsy Motel heard the impact, he said. She ran out to help, but the old man was dead. She was the one who called the police. You remember her name? Not offhand. Mr. McKell would be able to tell you, I'm sure. It's possible she's still there. I think I better talk to him in any event. If the driver was found, I won't need to take any more time with the questions. I'd like to think he would have told us if that were the case. Please give me a call and let me know what you find. I'd feel better about it. I'll do that, Mr. Hugo, and thanks for your help. I called Hartford McKell from a public telephone booth that was located near a hamburger stand on Upper State. There was no point in going back to the office when the accident site was only 2 blocks away. I pulled out a pen and a notepad, prepared to take notes. The man who answered the phone identified himself as Hartford McKell. I explained who I was and the information I needed. He sounded like a man without humor, direct, impatient, with a tendency to interrupt. In the matter of his father's death, he made it clear he wasn't interested in commiseration of any sort. The story seemed to spill out, his anger unabated by the passage of time. I refrained from comment except for an occasional question. The driver of the vehicle had never been found. The Santa Teresa police had conducted an intense investigation, but aside from the skid marks, there hadn't been much in the way of evidence at the scene. The only witness, the motel desk clerk, whose name was Regina Turner, had given them a sketchy description of the truck, but she hadn't seen the license plate. It was one of those traffic fatalities that outraged the community, and he'd offered a $25,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the driver. I brought Pop down here from San Francisco. He'd had a stroke, and I wanted him close. You know where he was headed every time he left? He thought he was still up there, just a few blocks from his place. He was trying to get home because he was worried about his cat. Animal's been dead now for 15 years, but Pop wanted to make sure his cat was okay. It makes me crazy to think someone's gotten away with murder. I can understand. He cut me off. No one can understand, but I'll tell you one thing. You don't run over an old man and then drive on without a backward glance. People panic, I said. One in the morning, the streets are virtually empty. The driver must have figured no one would ever know the difference. I don't really care what the reasoning was. I want to nail this son of a bitch. That's all I care about. Do you have a line on this guy or not? I'm working on it. You find the driver, and that $25,000 is yours. I appreciate that, Mr. McKell, but that's not my prime interest in the matter. I'll do what I can. We terminated the conversation. I got back in the car and drove the 2 blocks down State Street to the intersection where the elder McKell was killed. The intersection formed by the 2 cross streets was bounded by a motel, a vacant lot, a garden-style medical complex, and a small bungalow which looked like a private residence, converted now to real estate offices. The Gypsy was an unassuming block of units, with all the architectural grace of a 2x4, bounded on all sides by strip parking. An accordion-pleated metal portico jutted out in front. The 2-story building had probably gone up in the 60s and seemed to rely heavily on concrete and aluminum frame sliding doors. I parked in the portion of the motel lot set aside for registration. The office was glass enclosed with ready-made mesh drapes blocking out the early afternoon sun. A blinking neon sign out in front alternated no and vacancy. The woman behind the desk was big. Not the giant, but the large economy size. She had a big, well-shaped nose, a large mouth rosy with lipstick, ice-blonde hair pulled up in a braid on top,
the coil of hair wrapped around itself until it formed a rope. She wore mauve glasses with beveled frames, the lower portion of both lenses smudged slightly with peachy foundation makeup. Her street clothing was obscured by a pink nylon smock of the sort worn by cosmetologists. I took out a business card and placed it on the counter. I wonder if you can help me. I'm looking for Regina Turner. Well, I'll try. I'm Regina Turner. Glad to meet you, she said. We shook hands. Our conversation was put on hold briefly when the telephone rang. She held one finger up as a digital marker while she verified some reservations. Sorry for the interruption, she said when she'd hung up. She gave my card a perfunctory glance and then focused a sharp look on my face. I don't answer questions about the folks who stay here. This is about something else, I said. I was halfway through my explanation when I saw her clock out. I could tell she'd already leapfrogged to the end of the conversation. You can't help me, I said. I wish I could, she replied. The police talked to me just after that poor old man was killed. I felt awful, honestly, but I told them everything I know. You were working that night. I work most nights. Any more, you can't get good help, especially around the holidays. I was right here at the desk when the accident occurred. I heard the squeal. That's an awful sound, isn't it? And then a thump. This pickup must have barreled around the big bend out there at 60 miles an hour. The truck caught the old fella in the crosswalk and flung him right up in the air. Looked like somebody been gored by a bull. You know how in the movies you see him get tossed like that? He came down so hard I could hear him hit the pavement. I looked out the front window and saw the truck pull away. My view of the intersection is excellent. You can see for yourself. I dialed 911 and went out to see what I could do. By the time I got to him, the poor man was dead and the truck had taken off. Do you remember the time? 11 minutes after 1. I had that same little digital clock sitting on the counter, and I remember seeing that the time was 111, which is my birthday. January 11th. I don't know why, but something like that will stick with you for years afterwards. You didn't see the driver? Not at all. I saw the truck. It was white with some kind of dark blue logo on the side. What kind of logo? She shook her head. That I can't help you with. This is good, though. Every little bit helps, I said. There were probably only 6,000 white trucks in California. The particular pickup involved in the accident might have been junked, repainted, sold, or taken out of state. I appreciate your time. You want your card back? She asked. You keep it. If you think of anything that might help, I hope you'll get in touch. Absolutely. At the door, I hesitated. Do you think you could identify the truck if I brought you some pictures? I'm pretty sure I could. I may not remember it, but I think I'd recognize it if I saw it again. Great. I'll be back. I returned to my car, aware of the little rush of hope I was having to subdue. I wanted to make an assumption here. I'm not a fool. I could see the probability that the white pickup truck involved in Mikkel's death was the same pickup that had bumped into David Barney approximately 30 minutes later and approximately 8 miles away. There was too much at stake to jump to conclusions about who was driving it. Better to play it by the book as I'd been taught. The first step was to take pictures of several similar vehicles, including the truck owned by Tippy's father, Chris White. If Regina Turner could make a positive ID, then I'd have something concrete to start with. Step two, of course, was to figure out who had actually been at the wheel. Chapter 14. I went back to the office, again parking my car in Lonnie's slot. As usual, I took the stairs two at a time all the way to the third floor, and spent a moment leaning against the wall, gasping while I recovered my breath. I let myself into the law office through the plain unmarked door halfway down the hall from the entrance. It was an exit we used as a shortcut to the bathrooms across the hall from us. Originally, the third floor consisted of six separate suites, but Kingman and Ives had gradually assimilated all the available space except for the restrooms, located in the corridor so as to be accessible to the public. I unlocked my door and checked for messages. Louise Mendelberg had called, wondering if there was any way I could get Morley's keys back to them that afternoon. Morley's brother was due in, and they wanted to make his car available. Any time would be fine if it was not too much trouble. I decided to get my desk organized and then Xerox the files I'd picked up at Morley's house so I could return them at the same time. I sat down and went through the mail, putting bills in one pile and junk in the wastebasket. I opened all the bills and did some quick mental arithmetic. Yes, I could pay them. No, I couldn't quit my job and retire on my savings, which were nil anyway. I peeked at the balance in my checkbook and paid a bill or two just for sport. Take that, gas and electric. Ha ha ha, foiled again, Pacific Telephone. I gathered up the stack of folders and went down to use the copier. It took me 30 minutes to Xerox all the data and reassemble the files. I put the originals back in the grocery bag Louise had given me for the purpose, set aside a box of files to review at home, and then removed my 35mm camera from the bottom drawer and loaded it with a roll of color film. I hauled out the telephone book and looked up Tippy's father in the yellow pages under painting contractors. Chris White's company, Olympic Painting, was featured in a substantial quarter-page box ad that listed his name, company address, telephone number, license number, and the scope of his work. Complete painting services, water blasting, we provide the water, custom colors and matching, fine wood refinishing, wallpapering. I jotted down all the information relevant to my purposes. After I dropped off the files, I was going to go find 5 or 6 white pickup trucks and take pictures. I had a quick chat with Ida Ruth and then went out by the same door I'd entered, hauling the grocery bag and a cardboard box. The drive to Colgate was pleasant enough. The day was clear and chilly, and I flipped on the VW's heater so that it would blow hot breath on my feet. I was beginning to give serious thought to the possibility that David Barney might be innocent. Up to this point, we'd all been operating on the assumption that he was the one who shot Isabel. He was the obvious suspect, with the means, the motive, and the opportunity to have killed her. But murder is an aberrant deed, often born of passions distorted by obsessiveness and torment. Emotion doesn't travel in a straight line. Like water, our feelings trickle down through cracks and crevices, seeking out the little pockets of neediness and neglect, the hairline fractures in our character usually hidden from public view. Beware the dark pool at the bottom of our hearts. In its icy black depths dwell strange and twisted creatures it is best not to disturb. With this investigation, I was once again uncomfortably aware that in probing into murky waters, I was exposing myself to the predators lurking therein. Morley Shine's driveway was empty. The red Ford rental car nowhere in evidence. The Mercury still sat on the grass in the side yard. I stood on the porch and studied the pattern of rust spots on the fender while I waited for someone to answer my knock. 2 minutes passed. I knocked again, this time louder, fervently hoping that I wasn't rousing Dorothy Shine from her sickbed. After 5 minutes, it seemed safe to assume that no one was home. Maybe Louise had taken Dorothy to the doctor, or the two had been required to put in an appearance at the funeral home to pick out a casket. Louise had told me they left the back door unlocked, so I made my way around the side of the house, passing through the breezeway between the garage and house. The door to the utility room was not only unlocked, but slightly ajar. I rapped again at the glass, and then waited the requisite few minutes in case someone was home. Idly I surveyed the premises, feeling vaguely depressed. The property looked as though it was ready for the auction block. The backyard was neglected, the winter grass dry and frost-cropped. In the weedy flower beds that bordered the yard, last autumn's annuals were still planted in dispirited clumps. Once sunny marigolds had turned brown, a garden of deadheads with leaves limp and withered. Morley probably hadn't sat out here with his wife for a year. I could see a built-in brick barbecue, the cook surface so rusty the rods on the grill nearly touched each other. I pushed the door all the way open and let myself in. I wasn't sure why I was being so meticulous. Ordinarily, I'd have popped right in and had a look around, just because I'm nosy and the opportunity was presented. This time, I really didn't have the heart to snoop. Morley was dead, and what remained of his life should be safe from trespass. I left the grocery bag of files on the washing machine as instructed. The very air smelled medicinal, and from the depths of the house, I could hear the ticking of a clock. I pulled the door shut behind me and returned to the street. As I took out my car keys, I realized with a flash of irritation that I'd meant to leave Morley's keys in the bag with the files. I turned on my heel and retraced my steps at a half trot. As I passed the Mercury, I could feel my steps slow. "Wonder what he has in the trunk," my bad angel said. Even my good angel didn't think it would hurt to look. I'd been given ready access to both his offices. I had his very keys in hand, and in the interest of thoroughness, it seemed only natural to check his vehicle. It was hardly trespassing when I had implied permission. By the time I reached that phase of my rationalization, I had popped open the trunk and was staring down in disappointment at the spare tire, the jack, and an empty Coors beer can that looked as if it had been rolling around in there for months. I closed the trunk and moved around to the driver's side, where I unlocked the car and searched the interior, starting with the rear. The seats were covered in a dark green suede cloth that smelled of cigarette smoke and ancient hair oil. The scent conjured up a quick flash of Morley and a sharp jolt of regret. "God, Morley, help me out here," I said. The floor in the back netted me a gas receipt and a bobby pin. I wasn't really sure what I was looking for. An invoice, a pack of matches, or a mileage log. Anything to indicate where Morley had gone and what he'd done in the course of his investigation. I slid into the driver's seat and placed my hands on the steering wheel, feeling like a kid. Morley's legs were longer than mine, and I could barely reach the brakes. Nothing in the map pockets, nothing on the dashboard. I leaned over to my right to check the glove compartment, which I found crammed with junk. This was more my speed. Cleaning rags, a lady's hairbrush, more gas receipts, all local and none recent, a crescent wrench, a pack of Kleenex, a used windshield wiper blade, proof of insurance and registrations for the last 7 years. I removed item after item, but nothing seemed pertinent to the case itself. I returned everything to the glove compartment, tidying the contents in the process. I straightened up and put my hands on the steering wheel again, imagining I was Morley. Half the time when I search, I don't find jack shit, but I never give up hope. I'm always thinking something's going to come to light if I just open the right drawer, stick my hand in the right coat pocket. I checked the ashtray, which was still full. He'd probably spent a lot of time in the Merc. In this business, where you're on the road a lot, your car becomes a traveling office, a surveillance vehicle, the observation post for a night-long stakeout, even a temporary motel if your travel funds run short. The Mercury was perfect, aging and nondescript, the sort of vehicle you might note in your rear view without really seeing it. I checked the car above eye level. On the sun visor, he'd attached a leather-finish vinyl utility valet with a mirror, a slot for sunglasses, and a pencil and blank memo pad that looked unused. The valet was attached to the visor by two flimsy metal clamps. I reached up and pulled the visor down. On the underside, Morley'd slipped a 6-inch strip of paper under one of the clamps. It was the perfect place to tuck such things. To-do lists, receipts for cleaning, parking lot tickets. The strip had been torn from a perforated flap for one of the film envelopes used by a 1-hour photo mart in a Colgate shopping mall. The strip showed an order number, but no date, so it might have been up there for months. I slipped the paper in my pocket, got out of the car, and locked it up again. I completed the return trip to the utility porch, where I dropped the keys in the brown bag with the files I'd left. I drove the 5 blocks to the mall. An Asian fellow wearing rubber gloves was visible through the plate glass window of the 1-hour photo mart, removing strips of film from the developer. Prints on a conveyor moved slowly down one side of the window and across the front. Fascinated, I paused, watching as a surprise 40th birthday party progressed from cake and wrapped presents on a table to a crowd of grinning well-wishers looking smug and self-satisfied, while the birthday boy in sweaty tennis togs pretended to be a good sport. I was stalling, postponing the inevitable. I wanted the photo order to be pivotal. I wanted the pictures to relate to the investigation in some terribly meaningful and pithy way. I wanted to believe Morley Schein was as good a private eye as I'd always believed he was. Oh, well. I pushed the door open and went in. Might as well get it over with. Chances were I'd be looking at a set of snapshots from his last vacation. The interior of the shop smelled of acrid chemicals. The place was empty of customers, and the young clerk who waited on me took no time at all coming up with the order. I paid $7.65, and he assured me that I'd be reimbursed for any prints I didn't like. I left the envelope sealed until I reached my car. I sat in the VW and rested the envelope on the steering wheel. Finally, I opened the top flap and slid the prints into the light. I made a startled sound, not a real word, but something punctuated with an audible exclamation point.
End of Disc 5. Disc 6.
I made a startled sound, not a real word, but something punctuated with an audible exclamation point. There were 12 prints altogether, each marked at the bottom with last Friday's date. What I was looking at were 6 white pickup trucks, 2 views each, including one with a dark blue logo with 5 interlocking rings. The company was Olympic Painting Contractors. Chris White's name was printed underneath with a telephone number. Morley had been on the same track I was, but what did it mean? I sorted back through the photographs. It looked as though he'd done exactly what I meant to do. He'd apparently visited various businesses and used car lots around town and taken pictures of 6- and 7-year-old white pickups, some with logos, some without. In addition to Chris White's company truck, there was one utilized by a gardening firm and one used by a catering company with a camper shell on top. Clever touch. Because he'd incorporated a variety of trucks in the lineup, it was possible that a more detailed recollection might be triggered from the one and only witness we had. I stared out the car window, pondering the implications. If he'd talked to Regina Turner at the Gypsy Motel, she'd never mentioned it to me. Surely she'd have brought it up if she'd been queried twice about the same 6-year-old fatal accident. But how else could he have known about the logo and color of the vehicle if not from her? David Barney might have told him about the truck that nearly knocked him down. Morley might have thought to check old issues of the newspaper, just as I had myself. Maybe he acquired a copy of the original police report on the hit and run, and then decided to take the pictures with him when he interviewed the only witness. A description of the truck plus Regina's name and place of business would have been noted by the first officer on the scene. The problem was, I hadn't spotted the police report among the files I'd found, nor had I seen any photocopies of the newspapers to indicate that he was curious about other incidents on the night Isabel was killed. When I'm working a case, I tend to take a lot of notes. If anything happened to me, the next investigator coming down the pike would know what I'd done and where I'd meant to go next. Clearly, Morley didn't work that way. Or did he? I'd always given him credit for being both smart and efficient. The guy who trained me in the business was a nut about details, and since he and Morley had been partners, I'd assumed it was an attitude they shared. I suspect that's why I was so dismayed when I finally saw Morley's offices. It was the chaotic state of his paperwork that made me question his professionalism. What if he wasn't as disorganized as he seemed? A sudden image intruded. When I was a kid, there was a novelty item that circulated through our elementary school. It was a fortune-telling device, a crystal ball that consisted of a sealed sphere with a little window, the whole of it filled with dark water in which a many-sided cube floated. The cube had various messages written on it. You would pose a question and then turn the ball upside down in your hand. When you righted it, the cube in the water would float to the surface with one of the printed messages uppermost. That would be the answer to your query. In my gut, I could feel a message begin to rise to the surface. Something was off here, but what? I thought about what David Barney'd said when he'd suggested Morley's death was a shade too convenient. Was there something to that? It was a question I couldn't stop and pursue at the moment, but it had a disquieting energy attached to it. I set the notion aside, but I had a feeling it was going to stick to me with a certain burr-like tenacity. At least with the pictures, Morley had saved me a step, and I was grateful for that. I took comfort from the fact that we were thinking along the same lines. I could go straight back to the gypsy and show these to Regina. "Well, that was quick," she said when she caught sight of me. "I was lucky," I said. "I came across a batch of snapshots that should do the job. I'll be happy to take a look. I have one question first. Did you ever hear from an investigator named Morley Shine?" Her face clouded briefly. "No, I don't think so. Not that I recall. In fact, I'm sure not. I'm good with names. My return customers like to be remembered. And his is unusual. I'd know if I'd talked to him, especially about this. What's the connection?" "He was working on a case until 2 days ago. He died Sunday evening of a heart attack, which is why I was called in. It looks like he saw a link between the same two incidents." "What was the other one? When you were here earlier, you said a near miss of some sort. A white pickup truck bumped a guy at an exit off the southbound 101. This was about 1:45. He claims he knew the driver, though he had no idea there'd been a hit-and-run earlier." I held out the envelope. "Morley Shine dropped these off to be developed. If he meant to talk to you, he was probably waiting until he picked up the prints for ID purposes." I placed the envelope on the counter. She adjusted her glasses and removed the 12 snapshots. She studied them thoughtfully, giving each picture her undivided attention before she laid it on the counter, making a line of trucks, like a motorcade, that marched across the blotter. I watched for a reaction, but when Tippy's father's truck crossed her line of vision, there was no alteration in her expression, no remark indicating surprise or recognition. She studied the 6 trucks with care and then put an index finger on the Olympic painting pickup. She said, "This is the one." "You're sure of that?" "Positive." She picked up the print and held it closer. "I never thought I'd see this again." She flashed me a look. "Maybe we'll finally see someone brought to justice after all these years. And wouldn't that be nice?" I had a brief image of Tippy. "Maybe so," I said. "Anyway, you'll hear from the police as soon as I talk with them." "Is that where you're off to?" I shook my head reluctantly. "I have something else to do first." I made a quick call to Santa Teresa Shellfish, but Tippy'd traded shifts and wasn't going to be in that day. I left the motel and headed for Montebello, hoping I could catch Tippy at home, preferably without her mother hovering in the background. In essence, I'd put the woman on notice. Ree knew something was up, though she probably didn't have a way to guess just how serious it was. West Glen is one of the primary arteries through Montebello, a winding, 2-lane road lined with tall hedges and low stone walls. Morning glories spilled over the fence tops in a waterfall of blue. The gnarled branches of the live oaks were laced together overhead, the sycamores interplanted with eucalyptus and acacia trees. Thick patches of hot pink geraniums grew by the road like weeds. The small stucco cottage that Ree and Tippy occupied was a 2-bedroom bungalow built close to the road. I squeezed my car in on the shoulder and walked up the path to the porch where I rang the bell. Tippy appeared almost instantly, shrugging into her jacket, purse and car keys in hand. She was clearly on her way out. She stared at me blankly with her hand on the doorknob. "What are you doing here?" "I have a couple more questions, if you don't mind," I said. She hesitated, debating, then she checked her watch. Her expression denoted a little impromptu wrestling match. Reluctance, annoyance, and good manners doing takedowns.
God, I don't know. I'm meeting this friend of mine in about 20 minutes. Could you, like, really make it quick?
Sure. Can I come in? She stepped back, not thrilled, but too polite to refuse. She was wearing jeans and high-heeled boots, a portion of a black leotard visible under her blue denim jacket. Her hair was down today, and it trailed halfway down her back, strands still showing waves where the French braid had been undone. Her eyes were clear, her complexion faintly rosy. Somehow it made me feel bad that she looked so young. I took in the cottage at a glance. The interior consisted of a combination living room, dining room, tiny galley-sized kitchen visible beyond. The walls were hung with original art, probably Ree's handiwork. The floors were done in Mexican paving tiles. The couch was upholstered in hand-painted canvas, wide brush strokes of sky blue, lavender, and taupe, with lavender and sky blue pillows tossed carelessly along its length. The side chairs were inexpensive Mexican imports, caramel-colored leather in a barrel-shaped rattan frame. There was a wood-burning fireplace, big baskets filled with dried flowers, lots of copper pots hanging from a rack in the kitchen area. Dried herbs hung from the crossbeams. Through French doors I could see a small courtyard outside with a pepper tree and lots of flowering plants in pots. Your mom here?
She went up to the market. She'll be back in a minute. What did you want? I'm really, really in a hurry, so I can't take too long.
I took a seat on the couch, a bit of a liberty as Tippy hadn't really offered. She chose one of the Mexican chairs and sat down without enthusiasm. I handed her the pictures without explanation.
What are these?
Take a look. Frowning, she opened the envelope and pulled out the prints. She shuffled through with indifference until she came to the Olympic paint truck. She looked up at me with alarm.
You went and took a picture of my dad's pickup?
Another investigator took those.
What for?
Your father's truck was seen twice the night your Aunt Isabel was murdered. I guess the other PI meant to show the pictures to a witness for identification.
Of what?
I thought a little note of dread had crept into her voice. I kept my tone flat, as matter-of-fact as I could make it. A hit-and-run accident in which an old man was killed. This was on Upper State in South Rockingham. She couldn't seem to formulate the next question, which should have been, why tell me? She knew where I was headed. I went on. I thought we ought to talk about your whereabouts that night.
I already told you I didn't go out.
So you did, I said with a shrug. So maybe your father was the one driving. We locked eyes. I could see her calculate her chances of squirming out from under this one. Unless she fessed up to the fact that she was driving, she'd be pulling her father right into the line of fire.
My dad wasn't driving.
Were you?
No.
Who was?
How should I know? Maybe somebody stole the truck and went joyriding.
Oh, come on, Tippy, don't give me that. You were out in the truck and you fucking know you were, so let's cut through the bull and get down to it.
I was not.
Hey, face the facts. I feel for you, kiddo, but you're going to have to take responsibility for what you did. She was silent, staring downward, her manner sullen and unresponsive. Finally, she said,
I don't even know what you're talking about.
I nudged her verbally. What's the story? Were you drunk?
No.
Your mom told me you'd had your license suspended. Did you take the truck without permission?
You can't prove any of this.
Oh, really?
How are you going to prove it? That was 6 years ago.
For starters, I have two eyewitnesses, I said. One actually saw you pull away from the scene of the accident. The other witness saw you at the southbound off-ramp on San Vicente shortly afterward. You want to tell me what happened? Her gaze flickered away from mine, and the color came up in her cheeks.
I want a lawyer.
Why don't you tell me your side of it? I'd like to hear.
I don't have anything to tell you, she said.
You can't make me say a word unless I have an attorney present. That's the law.
She sat back in the chair and crossed her arms. I smirked and rolled my eyes.
No, it's not. That's Miranda. The cops have to Mirandize you. I don't. I'm a private eye. I get to play by a different set of rules. Come on, just tell me what happened. You'll feel better about it.
Why would I tell you anything? I don't even like you.
Let me take a guess. You were living at your dad's and he was out and these friends of yours called you up and just wanted to go out for a little while. So you borrowed the truck and picked them up and the three of you, or the four of you, however many it was, were just messing around drinking a couple of six-packs down at the beach. Suddenly it was midnight and you realized you better get home before your father did, so you quick took everybody home. You were barreling home yourself when you hit the guy. You took off in a panic because you knew you'd be in big trouble if you got caught. How's that sound? Close enough to suit? Her face was still stony, but I could see that she was fighting back tears, working hard to keep her lips from trembling.
Did anybody ever tell you about the fellow you hit?
His name was Noah McKell. He was 92 years old, and he'd been staying at that convalescent hospital up the street. He had the wanderlust, I guess. His son told me he was probably trying to get home. Isn't that pathetic? Poor old guy used to live in San Francisco. He thought he was still up there, and he was worried about his cat.
I guess he forgot the cat had been dead for years.
He was heading for home to feed it. Only he never got there.
She put a finger to her lips as if to seal them. The tears began.
I've tried to be good. I really have. I'm AA and everything, and I cleaned up my act.
Sure you did, and that's great. But your gut must send you little messages, doesn't it? Eventually you'll get back into booze just to silence that voice.
Her voice shifted up into the squeaky range.
God, I'm sorry. I really am. I'm so sorry. It was an accident. I didn't mean to do it.
She hugged herself, bending over, the sobs as noisy as those of a child, which is what she was. I watched with compassion, but made no move to comfort her. It wasn't up to me to make life easier. Let her experience remorse, all the grief and guilt. I didn't know that she'd ever let herself assimilate the full impact of what she'd done. The tears came in uncontrollable waves, great gut-wrenching sobs that seemed to shake her from head to toe. She sounded more like a howling beast than a young girl filled with shame. I let it happen, almost unable to look at her until the pain subsided some. Finally, the storm passed like a fit of helpless laughter that peters out at long last. She groped in her purse and pulled out a wad of tissues, using one to mop her eyes and blow her nose.
God!
She clutched the fistful of tissues against her mouth for a moment. She nearly lost it again, but she collected herself.
I haven't had a drop of alcohol since the night it happened. That's been hard.
She was feeling sorry for herself, maybe hoping to stimulate pity or compassion or amnesty.
I'll bet it has, I said, and I applaud that. You've done a lot of hard work. Now it's time to tell the truth. You can't skip over that and expect recovery to work.
You don't have to lecture me.
Apparently I do. You've had 6 years to think about this, Tootsie, and you haven't done the right thing yet. I'll tell you this. It's going to look a lot better if you walk into the police station of your own accord. I know you didn't mean to do it. I'm sure you were horrified, but the truth is the truth. I'll give you some time to think, but by Friday I intend to have a conversation with the cops. You'd be smart to get your butt in there and talk to them before I do.
I got up and slung my big leather bag across my shoulder. She made no move to follow. When I reached the front door, I looked back at her.
One more thing, and then I'll leave you to your conscience.
Did you see David Barney that night?
She sighed.
Yes.
You want to expand on that?
I nearly ran into him coming off the freeway. I heard this thump, and when I looked out the window, he was staring right at me.
You do understand you could have cleared him 2 years ago if you'd admitted that. I didn't wait for her response. She was beginning to sound martyred about the whole business, and I didn't want to deal with that. Chapter 15. I stopped off at my place after I left Tippy and grabbed a hasty lunch, which I ate without much interest. There was precious little in the refrigerator, and I was forced to open a can of asparagus soup, which I think I bought originally to put over something else. I've been told novice cooks are chronically engaged in this hoary ruse. Cream of celery soup over pork chops, baked at 350 for an hour. Cream of mushroom soup over meatloaf, same time, same temp. Cream of chicken soup over a chicken breast with half a cup of rice thrown in. The variations are endless, and the best part is, you have company once, you never see them again. Aside from the aforementioned, I can scramble eggs and make a fair tuna salad, but that's about it. I eat a lot of sandwiches, peanut butter and pickle, and cheese and pickle being two. I also favor hot sliced hard-boiled egg sandwiches on whole wheat bread with lots of salt and Best Foods mayonnaise. As far as I'm concerned, the only reason for cooking is to keep your hands busy while you think about something else. What was bugging me at this point was this question of Morley's death. What if David Barney's paranoia was justified? He'd been right about everything else. What if Morley was getting too close to the truth and had been eliminated as a consequence? I was torn between the notion of murder as too far-fetched and the worry that someone was actually getting away with it. I went back and forth exploring the possibilities. His curiosity might well have been stimulated by his conversation with David Barney. Maybe he'd inadvertently stumbled across something significant. Had he been silenced? I could feel